Hi, you're listening to another episode of Zabuma Foolish with me, your host, Jay. I use the pronouns they, them, and it's time that we get into the gig, girlies. Let's do it. Also, I know not everyone who's listening is a girl. We have non-binaries, we have mask individuals, we have trans folks, we have men also listening. I'm sure there are a couple, so yeah. Hello, welcome all. Okay, let's get into this episode. Wow. Wait.
Zabuma Foolish, Foolish, Zabuma Foolish, Foolish, Zabuma
Foolish. Ooh, ciao. I just finished watching this docuseries called Being Serena. It's on Crave. I'm gagged, okay? I knew that Serena Williams was, like, that bitch, but I did not know that she has almost died, like, several times and still, like, managed to be for so long the number one ranking female tennis player. So I was watching this doc, by the way, and it's like, it's really cute. It's very short. It's like 5 episodes or something. And Serena is giving you life like the whole time. And it actually gave me quite an insight because I didn't have all the tea. Because growing up, I was a child when they were like just making their strides / becoming like famous. And so I remember being like a little kid, like, I don't know, 6, 7 years old. And I remember seeing them on TV for like a Venus like commercial, but it wasn't like Venus, the tennis player Venus, like Serena's sister. It was Venus, like the shavers. Does anybody else remember that? And it was just like, it was just like literally like them in their room, and then it was like them playing tennis, and then it like was like a cut to the bathroom, and it was like shaving, even great a tennis player's doing. Anyway, okay, so gag. And then it was also during this docuseries, docuseries, that's what I want to call it, because it wasn't a documentary, y'all. It was like 5 episodes. And it was during that I started to like think about how messed up it must be to identify as non-binary and want to play sports professionally, because that side of society has been so unchecked for so long, y'all. Like, y'all don't clock the ways in which the people who run sports, who run major tournaments, who run the Olympics, all of these things, like, those are all very much rooted in some really problematic ideas. The most problematic being that, like, the athletes are in service to the audience, or somehow that the athletes aren't, they don't have agency over their own bodies because they have decided to give their bodies to this sport. And therefore, the press, the sponsors, the fans all take priority over the actual players. And it's actually a gag. And you can see this happening right now with what's unraveling online with Naomi Osaka straight up just claiming her space, being like, I'm depressed and I can't do press conferences. And then the entire tennis press team being so wayward, being like, you're evil, you're horrible, we're gonna fine you $200,000, all this drama because she literally just tried to take a mental health day. And then y'all gagged because she said she watched y'all move so incredibly madly, and then she said, okay, fine, work, and she pulled herself out of the tournament. Okay, y'all, wow, we're like 3 minutes in and I'm just talking about tennis and being non-binary in sports, and I'm like, that, what does this have to do with animals, with wildlife? And to be honest, nothing. It doesn't. I just wanted to share a little bit about something that I was watching and reflecting on, because that was something I used to want to do way back when. Was I used to want to be a professional athlete. But something that, you know, did hinder me was this internal conflict that I felt within myself about the presentation of my gender, my own gender identity, and how I wanted to express that both publicly and for myself. And so I was at odds for a very, very long time with my own identity, with my own interests, with my own, I guess, attractions. And so I ended up, like, making this decision to, like, stop pursuing sports altogether, partially because I was told that I couldn't pursue sports and academics at the same time. And so I had to give up one. And then partially also because of this internal conflict I was feeling. And also, y'all, gag, I'm just remembering this too, because this is something I'll never forget. It may always be drifting around somewhere in my brain, but it will always be there because it was so violent. So back when I made this switch, back when I, like, actually had to make the decision, which was, and remember, in grade 10, they, like, tell you, like, they, like, at the beginning of the year, they, like, give you this piece of paper, and they're, like, you can sign up for classes on the left, so those are, like, all academic classes. You can sign up for those classes, and you cannot do your sports, or you can sign up for applied classes on the right, which were more, like, trades and, like, skills, laborious kind of classes, like, electrical, wood shop, auto, things like that. And you would still be able to do sports. And so I remember being like, well, fuck y'all. All of my friends are, like, taking chem and physics and advanced functions. And at that point, I hadn't even decided, like, what it is I wanted to do. I was just being competitive for the sake of being competitive. And I was just like, oh, I'm going to be in these classes with my friends so that I can, like, compete for the best grade between them. And there's something that we honestly used to do a lot of time in high school, which, I mean, is problematic if it's being, like, pushed upon you, but as, like, an internal kind of thing within a small group of friends. I actually think it was, like, a really powerful tool to, like, push us and motivate each other to, like, do better, be it within, like, do better than the next person or just do better than you did the week before. I think it was, like, a really strong tool. That being said, y'all, I'm sorry. We have done this trip down memory lane, and I'm feeling like Roger Rabbit. No, that's not true. Not Roger Rabbit. I'm feeling like, what was the name of that rabbit in Alice in Wonderland? The rabbit in Alice in Wonderland who's like, I'm late for a very important date, which is me right now. Feel like I'm late to introduce the episode. I've already introduced the episode. Oh, what am I on today, y'all? Truly, I don't know. Sorry. I'm all over the place today with my vocals. So with that being said, I realized that I can't do what I originally was planning to do, which was, you know, the classic setup, animal of the week, slap you with some 626. Then we slide all into our what's the sit section. That, we can't run that. We can't run that model. We can't run that today because I have a very exciting guest interview for y'all, and that is Nicole Jackson. I will actually go ahead and, I'll formally introduce her in a second, but y'all, when I tell you I could not edit this down further, we had a really fruitful conversation, and we originally planned to talk about more so, like, our academics, like, about the kind of, like, research we were doing, and mainly, like, wildlife, you know, like, the namesake of the show. But then it ended up just, like, evolving into this really beautiful conversation, just not only about our experiences as Black academics, the sort of synergies and the differences between them, but also looking at it a little bit more broadly in the context of taking up space in natural environments as a Black person, be it for field school, for birding, what have you. The conversation really, like, it got my Jerry girls in a twist, okay? Got my girlies right together. And I just left the conversation feeling so elated. So hopefully you feel the same way. And if not, then, well, I guess this episode ain't for you. Maybe you can go back to the older ones or wait to next week when we jump back into the regular segment station thing of things. Wow. Do you know when your brain just like says words that don't align with the thoughts that you're thinking? And so you say sing of brings instead of bring of sings. And neither of those make sense. Okay. That being said, let's get into the swing of things with today's interview. Today's guest is a graduate of The Ohio State University, where she was awarded the position as a Toyota Together Green Youth Fellow. This position actually went on to pave the way for our guests in terms of their role as an environmental educator and as someone who works intimately with urban youth in Columbus, Ohio. During today's interview in the episode, okay, which I had to, I mean, low-key edit it down a little bit, our guest touches on some of the steps that she took to not only become an urban naturalist, a biologist, a birder, but also what it means to be Black within natural spaces and national parks specifically. So without further ado, I am over the moon excited to introduce today's guest, Nicole J. Jackson. I'm envisioning you now like clapping and cheering. But let's hop into the interview with Nicole and we'll be right back after that.
Hi, hello, Nicole, and welcome to Zabuma Foolish. I am really excited to have you on. And I thought that maybe we could start with you just introducing yourself to the listeners. Maybe let them know where you're from, what your pronouns are. Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks so much for having me, Jalen. I'm really excited to have this conversation. So to anyone who wants to know a little bit more about me, I am in Columbus, Ohio, so I'm in the United States. I was born and raised in Cleveland, Ohio, but moved to Columbus, Ohio for school and have been here for the past 12 years. So this is essentially my second home now. Nicole Jackson, but some people call me Nikki. And it depends on if I know you very well. If I don't, I usually go by Nicole.
Got it.
But my pronouns are she, her, hers.
Do you hear that, listeners? It's Nicole for y'all. You ain't know her like that yet. Okay. I love that. Okay. Well, thank you so much for one coming on and doing the little intro. And I know that you were saying that you were a lot of the studying that you had done was in, you said, Ohio.
Yes. That's okay. Where I got my head start essentially with trying to figure out my life.
Okay. What was that journey like? Like, what did you go into uni for?
Yeah, so I got into nature and like my bonding and relationship with nature when I was really, really young. Mm-hmm. And that actually started at a point in time where I was in foster care.
Okay.
So nature was my go-to because I was really struggling at that point in my life and I needed space to feel safe and connected to things and beings. Yeah. So essentially it started as therapy. Nature was therapy. And then it progressed into, oh, there's a lot of things happening in nature. There's a movie that yes. is on.
Oh, that's
and cute. I wanted to know more about everything. So the plants, the animals, ecosystems. And I would visit a lot of, I would take a lot of time during school to read about, you know, different animals and plants and places I wanted to visit eventually and it just opened up my mind completely. So from then on, I was just hooked on nature and just wanting to explore more of that as a potential career path.
Oh, I am so, okay. I like hearing that story just like makes me feel like a lot of emotions, just because so often a lot of the like work that I do or a lot of the conversations that I have, especially within like the outdoor advocacy space, is like trying to convince people that like Black people need to be given space to just enjoy nature on our own terms, and how that will in and itself lead to the development, the further like advancement of our, like, of, I guess, our community within the field of environmentalism or within the field of zoology or within the field of biology, right? Like looking at the ways in which that exposure, that initial exposure, is so critical to developing that curiosity. Oh, and I just, wow, I just, yeah, the fact that you, like, are just a very living testament of the, that truth, just, it just speaks a lot to me.
Yeah, it means just as much to me, because nature has really transformed my life for the better, and I think had I not had that relationship so early, I don't think I would feel as stable as, you know, life throws you curveballs constantly, and there's a lot of plot twists. But with building that relationship earlier on, I was able to use that as a tool to really help me refocus my energy and really get back to focusing on my health and well-being.
Mm-hmm. That's incredibly powerful, I think. And I think that, well, actually, let me just backtrack it here, because I feel like we're talking about your connection with nature. We're talking about how this sort of has like not only been like very important for your health and your well-being, mm-hmm. but integral for the developing that initial curiosity for you. And I know that you, like, school for you finished maybe like what, back like years ago now. We won't we might expose the deeds.
I graduated in 2011, so from college. I got my bachelor's degree, so
okay.
It's been some time.
and that was in biology, right?
So it started out as biology because I wanted to go down the veterinary medicine path. So that was my second year of college. So I had to, you know, take all of the prerequisites, you know, the math, chemistry, biology, physics. And then I started down the pre-vet path. So just getting more into knowing the different courses that I needed to take to get ready for vet school. Mm. And then kind of figuring out and backtracking for me, I have 10 siblings. I'm also an introvert. So when I was growing up, like, I always just needed time and space to process my feelings. And I didn't do the best job of communicating how I was feeling, but people knew I wasn't like chipper, happy Nicole, unless I was in nature. So trying to communicate that to my family members that like, I need nature in order to like communicate with you all, because I feel like I'm going to go crazy if I don't, was really difficult. But at the same time, they knew it was something that I needed and it was important to me. So they never like, you know, there were moments where it's just like, okay, Nicole is such a nature nerd and like, she's all about this outdoor stuff, but it wasn't to the point where I felt like they were trying to push me out of not wanting to like, or push me out of not connecting with nature. It was always just like, okay, that's her thing. You know, we don't fully understand it, that bond, but we know it's doing something for her. So in their minds, they saw like that I eventually would have a career, you know, working with animals or out in the wilderness, you know, doing something. So for them, I love them to death, but it was definitely difficult to bond with them on those terms. So it just got much easier for me in school to explore more of that, in college, to explore more of that and see where it would take me. But I didn't want to put So this is where the transition happens, because I didn't want to put so much pressure on myself in the beginning stages of college, like the beginning years. So I realized it was very competitive. It's harder to get in vet school than med school.
Yes, it is very competitive.
Yeah, I think it's only like 25, 26 universities, veterinary colleges. And I saw, you know, all my peers going through the same thing of just like, oh, I have to do this much studying. I have to give up this part of my life. And I'm just like, this is way too much for my soul right now. Like, it is not this serious. Why does it have to be this serious? So I made the decision to like, you know, let that go. It was difficult because I wanted to do that since I was like 12.
Yeah.
But then I was just like, but do I want to go through that much stress for something that I might change my mind about?
Very real. And that, honestly, I think that's incredibly, like, I think, I don't know, you're using a lot of foresight maybe, or like intuition that maybe you weren't like necessarily actively aware of. But I think to like safeguard yourself in that way, especially within academic spaces, which oftentimes can be very unsafe for us as like Black people, because we can be hyper visible. We oftentimes don't have like the same access to power or like accountability that our peers do. And I just think it's just, I think that you taking that step to do that transition, I think is really powerful. But I'm curious as to, because this is something that I've noticed a lot actually amongst like there's only been a few as of yet, but I'm hoping to expand it with the show and through social media and more. But as I continue to connect with more Black academics, and especially Black academics within the field of like animal ecology, or just like the wider, I guess, field of wildlife, it's this interesting trend I'm noticing where we all sort of had this initial desire to be veterinarians. And I'm just thinking out loud here, but I'm wondering if part of that is due to what we are exposed of in terms of like what a successful career with animals can look like from a young age. And I often feel as though we aren't given the full range of representation of what that could look like. And oftentimes we all kind of go along this line of like, oh, well, vets, you know, you can make money with that. You can work with animals, that kind of checks all those boxes, right? Do you find that it kind of, do you think that that holds true for you?
Definitely. Not being exposed to enough, to not having a lot of choices to choose from, I think really limited me. But because, like you were saying, that intuition, that the introspective thought process, I guess, that I had early on, and I credit this to nature of just slowing my mind down and really seeing the bigger picture. And again, it all comes back to my health and well-being was more important to me than getting a degree necessarily, or feeling like I had to accomplish someone else's goal. So it became, okay, what can I see myself doing for the rest of my life without it feeling like the title is gonna thrust me forward, but I'm gonna thrust me forward, if that makes sense.
No, that makes, I am picking up exactly what you're putting down. I'm like, that makes so much sense to me. That is honestly, that is like incredibly powerful to hear, because I'm just like resonating so much with a lot of what you're saying. And kind of to like, to tie it back, because I think, this point on like not having exposure, I think, from that young age, or not even necessarily from a young age, but even as we're entering into the early stages of our academic or professional development, right? And I think that's why I was really, well, particularly excited to have you on, right? It's actually to discuss your participation and the co-organization of Black Birders Week, which I think has done an incredible job in terms of really increasing the reach and representation that we as Black academics studying wildlife like have mm-hmm. now been able to develop. But I just think I'm really excited to have you like talk a little bit about that. But I'm just like gushing because I'm just like so in awe of how incredibly powerful it is, just in terms of community, in terms of actually like inspiring individuals. But I'll let you maybe speak a little bit more about your role in the organization of Black Birders.
Right. So I had the chance to join. We were part of a group chat last year that eventually turned into a bunch of ideas amongst some of the members of creating a day, and then it eventually turned into a week that focused on our interests in bird watching and STEM careers, and really kind of honing in on the issues around police brutality because of the George Floyd murder, as well as the Christian Cooper incident at Central Park. We wanted to have a space where we can really talk about those issues and barriers around racism and white supremacy within these fields. So having that space, and, you know, it took a couple days to create that, which is like really short notice, but we had a lot to say. So for us, it was, you know, we're already on social media. So just creating more of that platform to build more of the networks and build more of the relationships outside of the group chat to really make the connections that people are seeking, especially during a pandemic. You know, there's an election, it was an election year, like all of this racial unrest that we are very familiar with. It's just, you know, not having time and space to really process our feelings and let people know that we're hurting and that we're trying to find better solutions to just live and thrive in a lot of these predominantly white spaces.
That is, yeah, I think, yeah, you really are like touching on a couple of things that I want to speak on here. And I think really quickly, especially for the listeners here who are predominantly, I know a lot of the listeners are from Canada. I do have some from the States and some broader area. So for those who are unfamiliar with the Christian Cooper situation, I guess incident, that was an incident in Central Park where a Black birder by the name of Christian Cooper was out birding in Central Park when a white woman from Canada actually then engaged in one of the most vile and aggressive and racially, I guess, motivated, you could say, forms of trying to control Black people in outdoor spaces. And this is something that is not only like symptomatic of white supremacy more generally, but is something that is very, very prevalent throughout history mm-hmm. of Black people occupying and being in outdoor spaces, is this right. idea that white people somehow have the authority and dominion to control how we exist and occupy these spaces. And this is exactly mm-hmm. what was playing out in the situation with Christian Cooper, where this woman who was walking her dog off leash was I cannot even believe, like, this situation was wild, was literally just asked to put her dog on leash and right. then escalated this situation into the point where she tried to call the cops, tried to weaponize mm-hmm. right her positionality yep. as a white woman in a society that upholds whiteness so much, to the point where if a white woman calls the cops screaming about a Black man mm-hmm. assaulting her, right, that actually creates a very significant threat to that Black man's life. And so this is just very, I don't know, it's very violent. It's incredibly surreal to me that we also like were thankful enough that there was footage of this and we were able to capture mm-hmm. it, because we know how this situation does turn out oftentimes right. and how it could have turned out.
A lot of it is recorded. Unfortunately, even with recordings now, you know, people are still in denial when it comes to our safety and protecting Black people. But then also thinking about, I guess, in the way she responded, had nothing, like it could have been just that. Can you leash your dog? And those are the rules of the park, and everybody knew that. But yeah. because of the language that was being used from fear and reacting, it's just things escalated unnecessarily. So then we see it playing out and we're just like, oh, this is happening again. So when people were asking us during Black Birders Week, like, how did you feel about this over and over and over again? It's a heavy weight for us that we constantly have to carry around because we know what it is.
And it's honestly, that's something so sinister, I find, when that question is coming from outside of the house. Like, when it's honestly coming from white people being like, oh, well, what is it like? Like, I can't believe this would happen. And it's like, do you know how you also take up space with Black people outdoors? Because a lot of white people don't understand the ways in which they try to control individuals' right. space when just when individuals are trying to occupy outdoors and mm-hmm. trying to be in nature, right? And I think that something, especially as Black people who aren't given oftentimes, right, the ability to, or just the opportunity, I should say, mm-hmm. to develop that relationship with nature from like a really young age, often find, I feel as though, at least here in Vancouver, and just through my life in Canada, right, it positions white people in this place of like superiority where they feel as though they've maybe like put in more time, they maybe are a better source of knowledge, they are a quote unquote expert in this space, and mm-hmm. so they are just trying to help you, but it really comes across as trying to control you. And I'm just wondering if
right,
like
which leads to more harm.
Yeah, exactly, right? And I'm sure you are quite familiar with this, but I'm wondering if there was any sort of larger public conversation that you were having around this during Black Birders Week.
Yeah, so we had a lot of interviews. So some of us were interviewed individually as groups to kind of talk about our individual work as bird watchers, STEM educators, and communicators, but a lot of it came from academia. So what does this world look like when you're out in the field as a Black person? Do you worry about your safety? Are those things concerns? And if they are, what's being done about it? So having some really honest conversations of bringing those things to light that we have to think about the gear that we have on, the places that we have to go to do field work, you know, whether it's rural or urban or suburban, like we're always looking over our shoulder essentially. And, at the same time looking to see if we'll have support if we do encounter a problem.
Mm-hmm. It's absolutely wild. And it's like, even when we do encounter a problem, oftentimes, at least in my experience, what that support looks like is insufficient. Mm-hmm. or non-existent, right? Yeah. It's often like support in aftermath or support in words only, and there's no like actual tangible follow-up, right?
Yeah.
And I just think that, yeah, that's something that especially, not just as Black birders, but as we're outside in nature, even as scientists doing like kind of this field work, right, is that exposure to harm while we're actually just trying to collect data is
or why are we trying to just do very basic outdoor things like hiking or biking?
Like, it's so incredibly frustrating that it just add, like that layer of complexity is added to our experiences, mm-hmm. As if just existing in this white supremacist world wasn't difficult enough. When we try and find these means of like going, not necessarily escape, quote unquote, but you know, reconnection or grounding. It's then tainted again with this white supremacist world. So I think that
us, I do feel like it's an escape, which is, I mean, that's for us to decide though, not for white people to say, this is how you should be enjoying the outdoors.
Exactly.
Or this elitist definition, sexist definition, like all of the isms and all of that stuff tie into that. But also thinking about the intersectionalities that we can't separate these things out. As much as I would want to say, you know what, I'm going to take time off from being Black, I would love to do that, but I can't. So essentially, you know, just really focusing and honing in on acknowledging those barriers and asking people to do better, like just to be better, do better, not even like we're asking you to do the bare minimum. It's not even like anything outlandish, I think, and really just wanting to get back to the doing, because we're, in my mind, I'm like, I just want to enjoy my time outside. I don't want to feel like, you know, I'm being stared at or asked, you know, ridiculous questions of, do you know where you are? Or how did you find out about this place? Where are you from? Yeah. Like, you know, like,
the most intrusive questions.
I'm enjoying
Exactly. And you know that those questions aren't coming from a place of genuine curiosity. And even if they were, they would still be invasive. They're always coming from a place of trying to make sense of your literal physical being in that space.
And if it doesn't make sense, then it becomes an issue with them.
Exactly.
Then
it becomes a confrontation, and then you can have situations like what we saw unfold in Central Park. I'm very conscious of time, so I don't want to keep you too long, but I know that
keep me for however long you want. I'm good.
I've just been really enjoying this conversation, but I want to pivot a little bit, because we, in a lot of what you were saying, right, is in this ask of people to literally do the bare minimum. But you're out here, on the other hand, doing the most. Like, not only do you have Black Birders Week on the fly, but you are also responsible for Black in National Parks Week. Am I correct about that?
Yes. So I'm on the Next Generation Advisory Council with the National Parks Conservation Association. Okay. And I've been with that group since 2018. So there's a cohort of us that are park advocates, and we want to build the next generation of park advocates and really express the importance of inclusion, diversity, equity, access when it comes to being in the great outdoors in public lands. So with that, I feel like I've had this idea for some time of just, how do I better make these connections connected to national parks, and like having more of these conversations of sharing stories and experiences of Black people in national parks. So Black Birders Week gave me that push that I needed, essentially. So shout out to Black AF and STEM and Black Birders Week for giving me that motivation. And essentially it's just, you know, highlighting the contributions of Black people in the national parks. We have a huge history, starting with the Buffalo Soldiers, and I'm sure even before that, and building these historical moments for the American history and how we see America as a whole through our experiences. So highlighting history, also showing people that Black people are going to national parks and using them in their own way, whether that be for, you know, health and wellness, education, connection to land, healing, whatever that looks like. I just wanted to create a platform to open up more of that dialogue, but also create a network and a support system for Black people to connect to each other across the United States, even globally. I don't know if it's expanded globally, but in terms
of... Oh, it will. I'm sure it will. Because national parks expanded globally too, so you know.
Yes. And it's very different. U.S. national parks are very different than the ones globally. So that's kind of where I'm starting, but I know these conversations definitely expand globally. So really just having and I'm learning too still, of just the history of exclusion. Not too long ago, there were Jim Crow laws, and Black people could not go to national parks.
Yeah, it was literally illegal for us to enter into these national parks. And then when it was legal, there was still the vitriol face, like, this is my nature. This is my land. And then you also have to just clock the white supremacist delusion of it all. The idea that you individually, as the sole white community, have access to natural spaces that you just happen to come across, as if people's Indigenous people did not live here prior to you coming through and just evicting massive amounts of individuals from the land. Like, it's just so incredibly violent, I find. And I think that then how that's perpetuated against us as Black bodies who were violently brought to this country and then further excluded from these natural spaces. It's just, I think that is
stolen people on stolen land. Yeah,
exactly. And I think that that's why the work that you're doing, especially within the space of national parks, I think is so important. And I'm curious, what is maybe something that is surprised you while you have been in that space within, while working within sort of the Black National Park Week agenda, I guess you could say.
Yeah, so I think I've been in, I mean, even before Black and National Parks Week, I've always been a part of these networks that promote inclusion in the outdoors for BIPOC communities. So that wasn't anything new for me, but having it specifically focused on national parks was something I wanted to delve more into. But knowing, you know, the percentage of Black people, it's like less than 7%. That visit national parks. And it's always been this ongoing conversation of why is that? But it's part of this bigger system, again, that was based on this foundation of white supremacy and racism. So for me, it makes sense that these, like, a lot of these questions can be answered from our history. Like, there's a whole ass history.
There's also, like, a whole-ass community. Oh, sorry, I don't want to cut you off. But.
Oh, no, you're good. Like, that just boggles my mind because it's not that, like, we all just appeared on this earth at a certain time and we're starting from the beginning. Like, it's, and a lot of that history, at least for African-Americans, is still fairly new. Just as, you know, America is a new continent, new country. Like, it's not this, like, old, you know, ancient thing. So for me, it's just, we have the information, you know, it's in textbooks, a lot of it's hidden, a lot of it's not taught directly to us, but it's out there. And it's just more of us finding that information, connecting to it and seeing that we can see ourselves from our ancestors, from leaders that came before us to say, that we were here, we made a dent, we made history, we did these wonderful things, we created our own memories, stories, and you can do that too. That we're not, you know, having to start from scratch, but we do have a blueprint.
Oh, I love that. I absolutely love that. And you see, if that is something that I had heard, or if someone had told me growing up, it would have just saved me so much more time, I feel. You know?
Yeah, because you're constantly feeling like you have to play catch up.
Exactly.
And that's the sad part of it, yeah.
Exactly. And I mean, again, I feel like we could really talk about, there's so many things you bring up that just make me want to go down all these different paths. I'm like, okay, now I want to talk about this. Now I want to talk about, okay, this is the last tangent kind of point. Listeners, I promise y'all, we won't get tangy, but I really am like, because you talk about this phenomenon, this question that people ask, well, why aren't more Black people outside? And I think that something that a lot of people don't recognize is the very tangible barriers, right, that limit accessibility to outdoor spaces. And I know that you, one of the things that you're centering, especially within this role, is accessibility. But I think a lot of people don't understand just how layered it is, right, when we think about the disposable income needed, when you think about the time needed, when you think about potentially childcare that needs to happen, or if you want to bring your kids, like thinking about equipment that you need to have, like all of these different, if we start to unpack and start to unthread these things, we look at, oh, well, who currently sets prices for equipment, who currently sets prices for gas, who currently sets prices for accessibility to park spaces. Well, look, it all holds with white people. It all holds with predominantly white people. And we start to see how this, again, is controlling our access. And I'm wondering, what is, for you, one of the, I guess not one of the most important, because that's kind of a ridiculous question, but what's one of the more, I guess, subtle ways in which you find we are there are, what are the more subtle barriers you think that maybe people don't know about when it comes to accessibility in outdoor spaces?
Yeah, so a lot of it is just the education, the education of the mm-hmm. system.
Exactly.
Like it's mm-hmm. a system. There's 20,000 plus employees. There's 300,000 volunteers. And then the representation, like what are the demographics? We know that, you know, there's popularity with certain parks. Ones that are like Great Smoky Mountains is in the top 10 list of most visited national parks at like, I think it's 10 million visitors per year.
Oh, wow.
But then out of that, like how many Black and Brown people?
Exactly.
And if not, you know, there's knowing that there's 423 park units. So that means that there's a mix. And when I was learning about, you know, briefly in college about national parks and their creation, you didn't have advertisements, you know, for Black and Brown people, Black and Brown families to go to parks because of the exclusive laws and policies, but also because you can't, quote unquote, be your authentic self in those spaces. So if you have a big family, like, are they going to have a bunch of picnic tables? Are they going to let you bring food? Are they going to let you ask questions? Like those kinds of things come up for me. And then because it is very the intersectionalities, I think, are really important to point out because, you know, there's transportation, there's mm-hmm. the amount of money, you know, and each park has, you know, there might not be a fee, there might be a fee. But then a lot of that, like you were saying, takes time to get that information. Do most of these people have that kind of time? No.
Exactly.
So,
on it.
So you might have an interest. Who's to say that you don't have an interest? But what's blocking you from getting more of the information you readily need to have that experience? Because there's, like, you take one step, you have to learn something new. You take another step, you have to learn something new. It's not just what mm-hmm. the outdoors is for everybody. Just go outside. I'm so serious when I say this. I wish it could be that fucking simple, but it's not.
It's not. It's truly not. And that's, I think we're kind of trying to make a point of this. I'll try here. I'll try, listeners. It's where this idea, right? Where it's like, it's because of how deeply, I guess you could just say, messed up the system mm-hmm. is when it comes to not just the educational system, but our economic mm-hmm. system, right? Our national park system, our history right. of
yep.
like environmental racism. When we look at all of these things, this is what we mean when we say, right, that like climate justice is intrinsically racial justice. Like when we say educational reform is also intrinsically racial justice, right? It's looking at the ways in which the system is so entrenched with like these very, very disparaging power dynamics, which yeah. ultimately benefit white people, right? When we look at how this is so embedded within that system, we like, okay, well, then these issues are actually not separate. You can't have a right. conversation about national parks and also not have a conversation about racism. You just can't.
Yep. Yep. And that time, the time is very valuable for Black and Brown people because of, you know, having to be able to take care of yourself, having income for yourself and your family to be able to provide a roof over your head, have a vehicle, be able to use public transportation. Like all of those things have to factor into, you know, having this idea of, you know, thinking about all that, but then also like, okay, I should be able to take time off to go to a national park and enjoy myself. Is really, it's not a simple thing to just like, I don't know. I've met so many people who are just like, yeah, I'm taking a road trip to these national parks. And I'm like, I wish I could.
Right? I wish I could. I'm like, how are you getting, what? Like, there's so many things at play there. You're like, what? Your food? The gas?
Right.
Also, what? Rent is due? You have bills? Right. who's driving? There's so many things. Mm-hmm. Do you have a license?
And even the places you're going, like, you can't just show up wherever.
You can't
just show up wherever.
Especially.
You're going to get some people that are not okay with that. Other people are more friendly than others, but more than likely you're going to get some looks. You're going to get questioned. You might get harassed. Like, that's the stuff that I think about, especially if you're not familiar with the area. It's even more, like, you know, heart pounding situations that happen.
Yeah. It can be incredibly terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
Listeners, I feel like I literally have just been going on all these different tangents, but I just love a lot of this conversation. And I'm just conscious again of the time. I'm like, okay, wow, we have been having a really good and thorough chat, loving that. But
well, if you want to do a part two, let me know. We can keep doing this because I'm enjoying this as well.
Okay, great. I will definitely reach out. I'm like, part two coming through. Okay. That being said, let's take us back now to a moment in time when, well, not we, because we didn't experience mm-hmm. this together, but for you, when you, just before you were transitioning from high school to college, what mm-hmm. is something that your current self would have told that version of you?
I wouldn't have gone to college had I known what I known as early.
Okay, come through.
Yeah, I think had I known what I know now, and maybe because I'm a Gemini, but I literally am like, you know what? Life is just full of it. I would have given myself even more time to explore my interests, not even like a career interest, but just what makes me happy, what makes me sad, like, you know, how can I help more people? How can I build more skills, like just life skills, not even career skills, but life skills. And I feel like nature has done a good job of that. Like, you know, teaching me patience, teaching me that, although there is, you know, definite destruction and chaos, among our world, there's just as much beauty. And those are the things I tend to, you know, focusing on the little things, and waiting for spectacular things to happen. So knowing that those things have popped up in different ways in my life, I'm even more grateful for the relationship that I have to the outdoors, because it's taught me so much about myself and my superpower of being an introvert.
Yes! We got it.
And then I can do whatever I put my mind to, but really knowing that I'm going to be okay. Whatever I'm going through, I'm going to be okay. Because I know myself. I feel like if you can't, like, if someone were to ask you, like, do you love yourself? Or do you know who you are? Can you explain who you are? And you don't have an answer, then it's not time for you to, what's the best way to say this? It's not time for you to blossom.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you're not quite there yet. There's still some inner work that needs to be done, and that's okay. But knowing that versus, you know, a lot, I've had a few platonic relationships in my life where people that I've come to know are really invested in their work. Like, the job is their purpose. But then outside of that, they couldn't tell you what they were interested in.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes mm-hmm. me really sad, because then that's just saying you don't know who you are.
Exactly.
You're giving the definition of yourself to a thing or to someone else's, you know, idea or goal, versus you saying, I'm going to take the time to learn this, process it, but also let other people know. And I think that's why boundaries, setting boundaries are, it's really important. Letting people know what you're okay with and what you're not okay with.
Yeah, that is, yes, come through. We said a whole sermon. That was lovely. You, that was really lovely put. And if I was little Nicole hearing that message, I would have been like, oh my, okay. It's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. That was really, wow. Wow. a little taken aback. Love that. Okay, let's tell the listeners let me just thank you so much for you taking your time today and just being in conversation with me and joining me on the podcast. I'm just, I'm really, really appreciative for this conversation. And I'm just like, I've got my head racing and I'm all curious. I'm just, I'm so
No, I appreciate you having me. And I know we didn't get to talk about bird stuff, but essentially when I started my environmental education career, I really, like, that's something that I was just like, you know what? I can transform this bird knowledge into going back to the connecting to the land, to natural spaces, but it helps us connect to ourselves. So I think that's something we need to pass on to the next generation, but also to continue uplifting ourselves, because we can't, someone told me, you can't do everything. You can do all the things, but you can't do everything.
Oh,
I don't know if I'm saying that right.
I like that though. The way you said that, that spoke to me. You can do all the things, but you can't do everything. If that is not a read, drag me. Okay.
So I feel like that's, I'm one of those people who are just like, I am interested, literally interested in everything. And before I thought that was a bad thing of like, I need to just focus on one thing and I'll be fine. But I couldn't get away from that. So now I embrace it as I'm on this, lifelong learning journey, and everybody should be on that journey.
It is, because ultimately the faster you realize you're on that journey, and also the faster you come to doing that work, to loving yourself, it functions as strength. It just helps you to just propel you in this world that is honestly just doing the most to try and tear you down. Can't thank you enough. Also, listeners, y'all heard, I know we didn't talk about much birds, but that you heard part two is going to be coming to you soon.
This stuff was still just as important.
Exactly. Where can they find you?
If they want to connect a bit more. I'm on Twitter and Instagram. So my Instagram is Nikki, Nicky.J10. And then on Twitter, I am at wildlifegirl09.
Okay. So I'll go ahead and put Nicole's contacts in the bio, y'all. In the show notes for today's episode, in the extra content over on the Patreon. So you can be sure to connect with Nicole a little bit more after the episode. But let's, put our middle fingers and thumbs together, a little bit of a ballroom clap. Yes, take time right now, listeners. Stop what you're doing. Actually clap. Yes, thank you. Thank you. Appreciate that. Thank you, Nicole, for being here and for joining Zabuma Foolish today.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Okay, bet you didn't know that your baby boy. I'm not a baby boy, but you get the expression. I bet you didn't know that your baby them could interview like that. Yes. Watch me slowly work on these interview skills. Z-Way will serve as the inspiration. Because if I do end up having an interview segment on the Netflix special that will be Zabuma Foolish, I must say, it will definitely be inspired by this moment. feeling very happy with that interview. Anyway, y'all, I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you want to connect with Nicole, reach out to her, you know, send her an email, send her a DM, send her, just send her some money, actually, give her some, Venmo her, PayPal her, okay, reach out to Nicole. Anyway, also, I'm realizing now, I'm like, reach out, how are you going to do that? All of Nicole's contact information that she shared with me, like her socials, her emails, all that good, will be in the extra content over on the Patreon. So that is patreon.com/jauntingj. And as always, if you were a fan of the episode, if you want to see Zabuma Foolish make it to the big screen, and you want to be able to tell your friends that you were integral in getting it on to some of these major streaming platforms, well, then go ahead, baby boots, and write a review. Give a rating, because that'll help me reach some of my more outrageous goals when it comes to this podcast. Anyway, okay, I'm rambling on. Y'all need to go have a great day, and I'll see y'all next week for another episode. Yay.